Okay, so today I'm with Drew Pavlou, the most problematic Greek Australian here. I'm second.
That's a good description, actually.
Drew, most of our readers or listeners are in the States and they might not know who you are exactly, despite your quite large Twitter following.
Yes.
So could you explain who you are and how you came to be known?
Yes, I've been up to many antics the past couple of years. It all started about, it's crazy to think about, but it's basically been 5 years now almost. So I'm becoming a boomer. But basically, when I was like 20 years old, I led some campus protests at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, against the Chinese Communist Party. And we're supporting Hong Kong, we're supporting the Uyghurs and Tibetans. And this was at the height of the Hong Kong protest movement in 2019. And I got beaten up at one of these rallies and got decked and punched. Basically, what happened was we had 20 people and we got surrounded on all sides by literally hundreds of rabid pro-CCP students, and in some cases, not students. There were men there with masks. And to this day, I think there were people sent into that crowd by the Chinese consulate in Brisbane as sort of like provocateurs designed to start fights and things like that. So, you know, 20 people on our side, we got surrounded by 300, 400 people. They were playing the Chinese national anthem. They were screaming out things like calling me a white pig. It was really rabid. And some of them were calling me Wog as well. I don't know how they got that. I don't know how they became aware of the famous Australian language for Greek Australians and Italian Australians.
Yeah. So for Americans, Wog is a racist term used for Greeks, Italians, anyone, I guess, Southern European, suave looking.
Yes. And it's kind of funny because I used it when I was stuck in the UK a couple of years ago. It's just such a like sort of, I use it all the time. You use it all the time in Australia and it's not really considered that offensive. I mean,
Wogs can use it.
Yeah, they repurposed it almost like how African Americans repurposed a certain word that's like banned for other people. But like it's kind of like almost like a term of endearment in some cases, but obviously it can be used in bad context. And I used it in the UK one time and someone was like, oh my God, that's like the N word here. And I didn't realize it was that bad. But basically they were hurling racial slurs at me. They punched me. I got punched in the mouth. That was the first fight I've ever been a part of in my life. I got decked. And there were Hong Kong students in our crowd that were pro-democracy. There were guys who got chokeslammed to the ground. There were some Hong Konger girls who had their dresses ripped by like Chinese Communist Party ultra-nationalists. It was really rabid. Like just picture basically like a group of like, just picture hundreds of like Klansmen, like KKK people attacking African-Americans. This is basically what it was. It was basically almost like a racial pogrom instigated by Han ultra-nationalists on campus.
And what did the university do about it?
Yeah, well, this is the amazing thing. And I guess this is how I first kind of came to sort of some level of prominence as a kind of Z-list activist. But basically what happened was the University of Queensland decided to go after me out of all people because they had so much money coming in from China, about $300 million every year. It was 20% of the university's budget. And the president of the university, Peter Hoy, he was getting, and this was not disclosed to the public, but he was getting a $200,000 bonus every single year and it was a secret bonus that was basically given to him for meeting certain KPIs. And some of these KPIs were related to developing the relationship with China. So like I got elected by the students onto the board of the university as their representative. And so as part of that, I had access to all these university documents. And I discovered that, the president of the university, Peter Hoy, was getting $200,000 a year for traveling to China and meeting with Chinese Communist Party officials to the extent that Chinese, and he had a really good relationship with them to the extent that the Chinese Communist Party literally gave him a medallion, Most Outstanding Individual of the Year Award for promoting Confucius Institutes worldwide. And Confucius Institutes are basically, they try and portray themselves as kind of like cultural centers. So they try and portray themselves, we're like just like the Alliance Francois Institutes. We're just the normal sort of language promotion institute. But really they're actually controlled directly by the Chinese government and they're funded directly by the Chinese government. And the curriculum that they teach is all approved obviously by the Chinese government. And so there's obviously a lot of self-censorship as part of this. And we found out that the University of Queensland had allowed the Confucius Institute at UQ to fund 4 courses related to China. And some of these courses were actually teaching students like that Hong Kongers were terrorists, like the Hong Kong protest movement was like a terrorist movement. When it came to discussing the crackdown, the genocide against Uyghur Muslims, where 1 million people had been rounded up into concentration camps, they asked students to consider the fact that Uyghurs are overrepresented in Chinese government terrorist statistics. So they were teaching basically like the Chinese Communist Party narrative on campus to students. And this is not like some kind of like flyby university. This is supposed to be one of Australia's like top 5 universities. It's supposed to be prestigious and like this great university. And
is this happening at many universities in Australia?
Yes, yes, it is. It is completely widespread. So the University of Melbourne, University of Sydney, about 30% of their budget every year comes from Chinese international students. And the University of Sydney under the President Michael Spence, who is now, I think, at King's College London. Let me just double check that. But he actually banned the Dalai Lama from speaking at the University of Sydney. And that was related directly to the fact that they had a huge portion of their budget coming from China. So we're seeing a massive amount of self-censorship. There was a lecturer at UNSW. So she was actually also working for Human Rights Watch, and she made some statements regarding the Hong Kong protest, the crackdown on the protests in Hong Kong. And the university highlighted her statements in a kind of like, I mean, they regularly promote the statements and the work of academics when it comes to, you know, public facing research and everything. So they did like a short little blog post about it on the UNSW website. And there was a petition by Chinese ultranational students to condemn her and sack her and stuff like that. And UNSW then released 2 separate statements. They released a statement to the Chinese students saying that they were deleting the website, deleting the blog post and censoring it basically. But then they released a statement to in English saying, oh, we support free speech and everything. So as basically my case, where the University of Queensland cracked down on me, they actually ended up spending about $500,000 in Australian taxpayer funds to try expel me from campus. So it was pretty crazy. They brought in 2 of Australia's top 4 law firms, and they initiated kind of like an investigation into me. And we did freedom of information requests. They compiled like 13,000 pages worth of documents on me in like 2 months. So they were combing through my entire social media, just trying to find anything that they could use to pin me on. Obviously, there's a very broad student charter that has a list of like requirements of students, and it's very broard. So if they want to spend $500,000 constructing a legal case to kick a student out for political reasons, it's very easy for them to, you know, just trawl through 3-4 years worth of their social media history and just smash them. And that's what happened to me. And they had all these really trumped up charges. It was a full on kangaroo court. Basically, they had one charge that said I had stolen a campus pen from a campus art shop. So like a $2 pen or whatever it was, they said that I'd stolen it because I had taken notes with the pen. I went into the campus art shop, I took down notes of the pen, and I put it back on the shelf without paying for it, and like 50 cents worth of ink. And they were saying that this was a serious level 3 expulsion worthy offense. Oh, and like, God. The crazy thing is like, they don't even expel people for like rape and like, like actual criminal offenses and stuff like that.
Yeah, but
they
were claiming that I was listening to another podcast where you were speaking, and someone didn't even get expelled for like torturing a cat.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
They just kept going to uni. No worries. Yeah. Whatever happens outside of uni, you can torture cats. You can do whatever.
My God. That was a crazy incident where, yeah, there was actually like, I think it was a Chinese international student actually. And the RSPCA prosecuted him because he brutally tortured a cat. I think he actually like put the poor cat in like an oven or something just so hideous and horrific. And yeah, he didn't get an expulsion case against him. It's fucking crazy, to be honest. So the university spent $500,000 going after me. And I think the reason they really, really wanted to get me was like, it was one thing for me to lead protests on campus and everything, but I escalated to the next level where the students of the university actually elected me to be their representative to the board. And then I had access to all the university's like secret documents, and I could find out that the stuff that they literally were giving the university president $200,000 a year for deepening relations with China and stuff like that. And at that point, they just wanted to have full scorched earth against me. And the crazy thing is, and it's almost unbelievable to think about this 3-4 years later, the Chinese government, through the Global Times, which is a state-controlled sort of propaganda media blog, and really the equivalent of it is probably like Fox News. Like it's kind of like it's like a really nationalist kind of paper. And they've like threatened to like nuke Australia and stuff like that. Like, it is a really hardcore, crazy blog. And they actually had Global Times say, we've interviewed Chinese students on campus and they all want Drew Pavlou expelled. And this is what we need to see happen because this guy is a racist and he's leading riots on campus. And so it was basically the official Chinese government position that I should be expelled from campus. And it's crazy because, like, to this day, people, like, I get heaps of trolling online from pro-CCP people, and they often go, like, oh, Drew pretends that he's been persecuted by the Chinese government. They don't care about some guy in Australia. How could they just care? But they literally had Chinese government-controlled state media organizations saying, expel this guy from university.
Well, so, tell our listeners what you told me when we talked last time about the bomb.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So this is by
that
far.
That seems to be the worst.
Yeah. This is like the craziest thing that happened to me. And to be honest, it kind of unfortunately led me to, in a way, really change basically my activism and stuff like that. Yeah. So like, I don't really do like in-person protesting anymore and everything, like, because of what happened. Basically, yeah, that whole UQ thing happened and they tried to kick me out of university. I was very lucky that one of Australia's best lawyers, like, represented me for free and fought back. And in the end, they suspended me for 6 months, removed me from the university senate, the board of the university. They kind of won, but they didn't completely win in the sense that I wasn't fully expelled for life and everything. And it sucks because they never really faced any consequences for that. And Peter Hoy went off to the University of Adelaide. He's the president of another like top 10 Australian university. And he's getting like $1 million a year. The chancellor who helped organize it, Peter Varghese, he got a 4-year contract extension. No one got it punished at all. And to be honest, there was even another crazy part where the Chinese consul general in Brisbane, who the university had appointed as an honorary professor, which is crazy, he actually had put out a statement endorsing the violence against me, and they did nothing to him, but they went after me. So just crazy, crazy thing. But it actually escalated to a point where, yeah, I got like unjustly imprisoned in London on like false terror charges, and it was fucking terrifying, to be honest. Basically, given who I am as a person, and it's probably the Greek Australian in me, like they smashed me, and I thought to myself, I can't just let this, I can't just take this lying down. I've got to just basically dedicate my life to protesting against the Chinese government, like to punish them for trying to go after me. So it was almost like, obviously I'm motivated by noble concerns about human rights and everything, but also to an extent, it was also like, how dare they, like, you know, try and get me bashed up and death threats against my family and all this
but
stuff.
But you've got balls. Like, this is a government who disappears people, you know?
Look, obviously I'm very lucky in that the sense that I am to some extent protected by my Australian citizenship. So it's way worse for my Tibetan friends, Uyghur friends, Australian, Hong Konger friends who live in Australia. They're Australian citizens and stuff like that. But they still get calls in the middle of the night from Chinese police threatening them, telling them to come back to China to face charges. Like I had Uyghur friends that were called in the middle of the night by Chinese police and everything. And here in Australia, they're Australian citizens because they had been photographed at protests and stuff like that. And I guess it was just the outrage of all this, the fact that they went after friends, the fact that they had death threats against my family, the fact that they tried to get me, like those guys tried to bash me, the fact they tried to get me kicked out of university for life. And I was a great student. I had such good marks back then. And I was 6 months away from graduation. And
you study law? Is that right?
I'm studying law now. Back then I was doing history and philosophy and stuff like that. Okay. And it might sound funny, but my dream at the time was to try like be an academic. Like I wanted to try to do a PhD at Oxford or something like that and be like a historian. I was really, really into my studies. I loved history. That was my dream back then. And then the university poisoned that forever with what happened. But basically, I just decided I'm going to like become like a full-time protester against these guys because of I was so outraged by their conduct. And I ran for election. We had like a small political party in Australia and it was like a protest party dedicated to fighting against CCP interference and influence in Australia. And we had Tibetan Australian candidates run and stuff like that. And it was all like we protested that the Chinese ambassador's maiden speech to Australia, disrupted it with like 10 different people. We every 5 minutes someone would stand up and start yelling and they'd have to get carted off and his whole speech got destroyed. And so obviously at a certain point, I think they really wanted to bloody my nose because I was obviously becoming very annoying to them and they had failed to try permanently expel me from campus. There was even a point where, again, people laugh and they go, oh, they don't actually care about Drew. Like this guy's just like schizophrenic. He thinks that the CCP is after him. But there was a point where the Chinese foreign minister the spokesperson for the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who does like international press conferences, Zhao Lijian, he ended up getting dismissed. He was very infamous because he posted a photo, an AI image or a cartoon image of an Australian soldier slitting an Afghan child's throat.
I remember that
guy. He's like a hardcore ultra-nationalist wolf warrior. Ended up getting dismissed, which is really funny. But he actually randomly brought me up at a press conference. Like, no one had even asked about me. And he just said, like, oh, well, this in particular is a lie propagated by the anti-China element Drew Pavlou and stuff like that. So, and they accused me of being paid by the Taiwanese government. And this was when I was still like 21 years old. Like, this was like back in
everyone accuses you of getting paid by everyone.
Yeah. It's funny. These days, they accuse me of getting paid by Mossad, the CIA, Taiwan. Man, it'd be awesome if I did. I wish they could be like, you know, parachute dropping the golden bars to me every day.
Okay, so the bomb threat.
Yes, the bomb
You're
threat.
In London.
So that was, I was trying to explain a bit of the context. I was like, hardcore, I'm going to protest these guys for the rest of my life. And I went to London. I protested the Wimbledon men's final. And to be honest, looking
where
back
Peng
now.
Peng
Shuai, the Chinese tennis player. The Chinese tennis player who was almost basically disappeared after she made a rape allegation against a top CCP official. And to this day, she's kind of like, I mean, I guess she can move around freely inside China, but she always has minders. She can't speak. You can't look her up on the Chinese internet and stuff. Like, imagine like the equivalent of, like, she was like right up there as one of the most famous Chinese tennis players, one of the most famous athletes in China. Imagine just like Serena Williams just being like disappeared and you can't even Google her name anymore. Like, this is what they're facing. And looking back, my protest tactics were pretty annoying because I probably was like kind of, I've never been like fully left or whatever, but back then I was much more lefty. And I guess I was like, I looked at Extinction Rebellion's tactics and I was like, how come no one does this against the CCP? And so I like was, to be honest, I now look back on it, I'm like, I was pretty annoying and it was probably too far and stuff. I actually wasn't trying to disrupt the men's final, but like I basically got up and it was like in between like a, you know how they have like three games and then they have a drinks break? I got up during the drinks break and I just held up like a sign that said, where's Peng Shuai? And literally the second that I held up the sign, they must have been watching me and they must have known who I was because I'd also protested the Australian Open. And they basically like grabbed my wrists and there was like four guys suddenly around me grabbing me. And I was like, shit, I've already flown here. I spent a lot of money to try to get into the Wimbledon. I have to do something. So I just yelled out like, where's Peng Shuai? As loud as I could. And I didn't realize that the game had actually resumed by that point. And so there was like kind of like a brief disruption of like, I guess 30 seconds. And I think everyone just thought I was an Extinction Rebellion protester and like clapped when I got carted out. And like, I don't know. It's kind of sad because I think if people realized that I was doing it for like a Chinese tennis player who had been essentially kidnapped,
yeah,
I think people would have been more sympathetic. And it's kind of funny because like Prince William was in the stadium and like Tom Cruise and all these like famous people and like Djokovic and Kyrgios like looked up in my direction. And just for like 10, 20 seconds, I was a very annoying person in the lives of, I guess, a lot of famous and important people. And I got like pushed down the stairs by security and like smashed up against the wall. They were pretty brutal. So I was an annoying protester back then. And I was just sort of like, I hadn't had a plan when I went to London. It was just to do the Wimbledon thing. And then like, I was looking to get flights back to Australia after that happened because I didn't really have anything else to do. And the prices had gone up to like $6,000 because everyone in Australia loves to go off to Europe in the summer. So I was like, shit, what do I do? And I just was like literally couch surfing with my mates in London. Very lucky there's a lot of Australians in London. And I just was literally bored. And I was like, oh, you know what? I'll go to the Chinese embassy because the Chinese embassy like fronts up right onto the street. So this is the difference, right? Like in Australia, the Chinese embassy is a military compound where it's like a kilometer back from the street. It's a whole compound with high walls and gates. Same with America. America has like a military grade compound in DC. And the one in London, you can literally walk up to the door and buzz the doorbell. So I was literally just going up to the doorbell and I had my friends like filming me and I was just being really annoying and I thought I was really funny. And I was like ringing the doorbell going like, hello, hello, can someone answer? I want to talk about Peng Shuai. And like filming myself and thinking that I was making these funny like Instagram reels and everything. And like, I went for like 2 days, like, and I guess they were getting pretty sick of me, like, because obviously I was just like protesting outside and being annoying. And like at one point a guy came out from the embassy and he said, you can't protest here. Like, we're going to call the police on you. And I was like, okay, do it. And then obviously, cause I didn't get scared. He just like walked back inside and didn't do anything. So I think they were like obviously getting pretty pissed off at me just protesting outside the Chinese embassy like day by day. And I came back like the next day and it was really dumb. To be honest, it was really stupid. Like I basically had like some glue, super glue. And I had like a Taiwan flag and a Tibet flag and everything. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be like really funny and glue it to the gate. And like with hindsight, really fucking dumb. I shouldn't have done that. And
because it's like property damage. It's like
£30 worth of property damage, I guess. I told the police I'm happy to wash it off. But anyway, it was dumb. I shouldn't have done that. However, what happened though was pretty cooked. And I think they went pretty, I think you can argue that they probably went a bit far in their response to me. So basically, somehow they knew that I was coming that day, probably because I kept on coming and like annoying them. And so it wasn't, I guess, like a great military grade top secret, like CIA information that I was just going to be annoying them outside the embassy every day. I went over, I had my friend filming me and stuff like that. I'm thinking, oh, I'm such a funny guy. I'm protesting, blah, blah, blah. I'm so radical. I'm Extinction Rebellion style. And then like suddenly, it's not good. Like I hear the security guard going, the embassy's under attack. The embassy's under attack into his radio thing. And I'm like, oh, what the fuck? And I told him like, I'm a peaceful protester, man. Chill out. And then suddenly like all these diplomatic police pull up and they're obviously all like armed and everything. Not that they're pointing guns at me, but they were all armed and they're like very serious and they pulled up in a van and they're really serious and they like rush out and they immediately like start asking me questions and stuff. And I'm like, I'm just a peaceful protester. And like, and then they ask me for my ID. I hand over the ID and then they see my ID card. They get my name and everything. And then immediately they grab my hands and they put my hands behind my back like that and arrest me. And they put me in a rear stack handcuff position. So like your arms are like that, really high up your back. It's almost like a stress position. Ow. And they basically only do that for like violent, like people suspected of like being violent and stuff like that. And so when they arrested me like that, I was like, what the hell? Like there's no need for handcuffs. I'm a peaceful protester and stuff like that. And they're like, just shut up. And then the guy filming me, my mate, they also arrest him and put him in cuffs and take his phone and stuff. Like, what the hell? He wasn't even doing anything. He was just filming. And so they just like frog march us up against the wall and we're just waiting there for 30 minutes. And it was getting really painful because it's like a full-on stress position. And I was like, come on, guys. Like, please just, please, can you just like recuff me? Put my hands at least in front of me. It's really painful. They're like, shut up. Like, you'll do what we say and everything. And they were like quite brutal and everything. And I didn't understand why they were taking it so serious. And eventually the cars pull up, they bundle us into the vans and everything. They still kept me in a rear stack handcuff position for the entire ride to the police station. So in the end, I was in that position for like 2-3 hours, like a stress position. It was very painful. I kept on asking them, can you please recuff me? And I was like, at one point I said like, you guys did this intentionally to make it as painful as possible, right? And they're like, shut up or we'll make it worse, basically. Like, and this was recorded on body cam footage and there was an ultimate investigation and Met Police like were like, yeah, we shouldn't have said that, but there's not going to be any consequence for that officer. In the end, basically, they held us for processing. It was like 3 hours by that point. They hadn't even explained why they had taken it so seriously, why they were arresting us. I didn't think I was going to get arrested that day, so I was not prepared for any of this. And like, it was at that point I overheard one of them say, oh, we've got them for what was it? They were like, we've got them for conspiracy. We've got them for trespass. We've got them for criminal damage. And I was like, conspiracy? What the fuck are they talking about? And I literally just asked them like, what do you mean conspiracy? Like, they were like, and I overheard them. They're like, conspiracy to commit false information. I was like, what the hell? Like, are they going to say that like I'm lying about what's happening with Tibet? I know that the British police are a bit cooked, but I didn't think they were that cooked. I actually just asked them like, what do you mean conspiracy? And then they're like, oh, don't play dumb with us, mate. You know why you're here. And I was like, no, I literally don't. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean? And it was at that point they told me why I was being arrested and treated like a terrorist suspect. And it was because they were like, well, we came over early in the day that day, like at 10:30, the embassy called us in and you sent a bomb threat in your name, Drew Pavlou. And I was like, what the fuck? And then I was just shocked. I was trying to think like, what the hell happened? What I don't understand. And then like after like 20 seconds, it hit me. And I was like, my God, these motherfuckers, they actually got me really, really bad. And I was so shocked. And I realized what it was because back in 2021, so like this was like a year before, my emails had been hacked by a Chinese IP address in Hong Kong, like a Hong Kong IP address. And they were sending out like false spoof emails from my actual name and stuff like that. Death threats to people trying to get me in trouble and everything. And it got so bad. Like I ended up having a cybersecurity company like investigate my entire email, look into it all. And they found the Hong Kong IP address and everything. We found out like the earliest known date of the breach was like January 6th, 2021. And that then it worked. We worked it out because like 3 days later, my Uyghur friend in Australia, his mum had been taken to a camp and like re-education facility. And we didn't know why at the time. And then I realized like, oh my God, we think it's probably because we had been in contact. Because when we realized they had my emails from January 6th onwards, I had communications with this guy. We're talking about his life in back in China, his family, all this stuff. And I was actually compiling like part of his story and giving it to Human Rights Watch, which was doing a research investigation into like foreign interference and threats against Uyghur Australians, Tibetan Australians and everything. So they hacked my email January 6th. January 9th, my mate's mum got taken to a camp, like a re-education facility.
Wow.
Which that was one of the worst experiences of my life. And I was just so sick. And honestly, at that point, I had thought about giving up everything with the protest. And my friend said, oh, please keep going, because like they would do this to my mum regardless. They always try and invent excuses to take people's families. They're always trying to threaten people. Please keep going. That's what my friend said to me. So I kept going. But it was the worst experience of my life up to that point. And when it then clicked in my head in the forecourt of like that police station, Hammersmith police station or whatever it was in London, my God, they've done the same thing to me again. And eventually they wouldn't show me the email until about 3 a.m. They actually, they held me incommunicado as a terror suspect. So incommunicado, you can't talk to a lawyer. You can't tell anyone where you are. You can't contact the Australian High Commission. Like I was basically being held in secret because they thought I was like a terror suspect. And they thought that if I contacted someone, even a lawyer, they could go out and destroy evidence and stuff like that. So I was being held like legit as a terror suspect. And eventually like they interviewed me at like 3:30 a.m. in the morning without like a lawyer present at 4:30 a.m. You know,
were
like,
you separated from your mate? The video
yeah, separated
guy?
From my mate. Yeah. And my poor mate, like, he even, for some reason, he even spent longer in the prison cell than I did. I think they ultimately let me go after about like 23 hours because I eventually, like after like 22 hours or whatever, they realized like they had to give me access to a lawyer or whatever. And I got through to someone and I kept on insisting for my legal rights and everything. And like, I like they had to give me like a sheet outlining all my legal rights and stuff like that. I started like smashing the door, like demanding my legal rights and everything. And I ended up causing almost like a prison uprising because everyone else in the ward started banging on their doors too. And everyone started yelling and everything because I was yelling. And I think maybe they thought this guy's just annoying, get rid of him. So eventually I think they worked out like, this is just bullshit. There's no evidence against this guy. We can't actually hold him, let him go after like 23 hours. But like I slept in a police station that night. It was pretty fucking terrifying. I was thinking at the time, like, my God, I could end up being in custody for weeks or something like that. And I was thinking like, my God, what is my mom going to think? All my family members, my friends, like I've just disappeared from the face of the earth. No one knew where I was. And yeah, it was very terrifying. They had told me that I was facing 12 years in prison. So like 7 years for a bomb threat and 5 years in less. And they said 7 years for a bomb threat. And then they told me to hand over my phone PIN to them so they could go through my phone. And I was like, I was thinking to myself, fuck no, I've got all these contacts with like Uyghurs, Tibetans, Hong Kongers. I don't trust these guys. I'm not giving over my phone. And they said, if you don't give us your PIN, that's another 5 years for obstructing justice. So they were saying, they told me like they pulled me in at 4 a.m. for an interrogation, like lights on in my cell the whole night so I couldn't sleep. And they like told me in the interrogation, like it's 12 years you're facing. So I was thinking, my God, like I could end up being in custody for even months, potentially in the UK while something has worked out, while people, it was so fucked, you know, it was like legitimately such a cooked experience. And eventually, yeah, they let me out after 23 hours because I just kept on banging on my door until they eventually let me go. And then like, but it was horrible. They let me out onto the street in London and I had just like £20 in my pocket and they had my phone. And I didn't know what the fuck I was going to do. So like, I just called someone at a payphone to pick me up. And then like, eventually I got home, I got to my laptop and like, I just told my mom and stuff like, oh my God, like this is what happened, everything. And they told me that they were going to go round to the place I was staying and take my laptop and stuff like that. So I was thinking to myself like, God, am I going to get a further raid? It was just the worst experience ever. And right. Basically what ended up happening was they wouldn't let me leave the UK for like 6 weeks after that happened. Because basically they were like, we're giving you back your passport, but if you try and leave, you'll get stopped at the border because we put a hold and like, we'll have you arrested if you try to leave the country. So at a certain point, I was actually even thinking of like escaping the country by like a boat or something like that. Because I was thinking to myself, like, it'd kind of be funny if I like just went home to Australia. And because the Met Police, they're not that competent, I suppose. And I just thought to myself, like, it kind of be funny if I, like, went back home to Australia and then the UK has to try extradite me and then, like, fucking make it a problem for the Albanese government. Like, are they going to extradite this guy and clearly false up, trumped up charges? It was just so bullshit. Can you believe it? They kept the whole case hanging over my head for like 9 months. So they basically, when they eventually let me go home to Australia, it was after like 5 weeks or whatever it was, they eventually contacted my lawyers, and it was so bullshit. I had to spend like thousands and thousands of pounds on lawyers, and they were just so exorbitant. They even just to send letters to the police asking if I could get my phone back, asking if I could go back home. And eventually they were like, Drew can go back home to Australia on the condition that he return on October 17 or whatever the exact date was, October 16, October 17. He has to be there in person for an interview at the police station. It can't be via Zoom. It has to be in person. So they told me I had to fly back to the UK. And so like, and obviously that's thousands of dollars, and it's just like really annoying. And I ended up having to like defer my studies for that 6 months and everything. And when I was flying back to the UK, I was thinking to myself, like, I legitimately thought, okay, there's going to be a real chance that I get arrested at the airport. I might end up being in custody for weeks while I wait like a hearing date or something like that. I thought, like, my God, if they're insisting that I literally return in person, that surely they're going to arrest me. That's what I thought. And I was saying goodbye to my parents at the airport, thinking, my God, am I not going to see them again for a year? My elderly grandparents, my Bapu and Yaya, I was saying goodbye to them, and it was very emotional because they're quite old now. And I was like really scared, like, what if I never see them again, you know? And so it was a really scary, dark time. I fly back to the UK. I get to the line at the airport, and my passport's not working. And I had to go into the solo line and everything. And I was thinking, my God, at this point, I'm 100% getting arrested. So I had like the scariest like 30 minutes of my life just waiting around in a line at the airport to try talk to someone in person. I thought 100% I'm getting arrested. But eventually they let me through. And would you believe it? I get back to the UK, and like, I'm waiting around for a couple of days. I was really lucky. Like, the Oxford Union actually invited me to speak. So I gave a speech to the Oxford Union, which was probably like one of the highlights of my life and everything, which is very cool. But, you know, I'm waiting around, and I'm obviously terrified and everything, that they're literally going to arrest me again, that there's going to be a trial and everything. Believe it or not, I actually talked to the Australian QC, KC barrister, Jeffrey Robertson, the famous human rights guy. And he told me he would represent me for free if it went to trial. So I was like fully expecting this to go to trial and everything. And then the night before I was supposed to go back to the police station, they contact my lawyer and they're like, oh, we don't need to see Drew anymore. We'll tell you when he has to fly back to the UK next time. And I'm like, my God, these people have trolled me so hard. All that stress and the terror of like flying back to the UK, expecting that I'm going to get arrested at the airport, going to trial and everything. And they're trolling me now. That was so, so frustrating. And in the end, I fly back to Australia and everything. I hear nothing from the Met Police for months and months and months. And it ends up being like March the next year. So after like 6 months of me, another 6 months of me thinking like, my God, am I eventually going to get charged? Am I going to have to fight in court to try and prevent myself going to prison? Eventually they didn't even inform me. They informed some journalists, oh yeah, we've cleared Drew all charges. No further investigation. And I found out from a journalist one day, I was just like chilling and someone called me up and was like, how do you feel that the Met Police have dropped charges? I was like, what the hell? What do you mean? They didn't even have the dignity. They didn't even have the guts to tell me directly, tell my lawyer directly. So that was the worst experience of my life. And would you believe it? When I came back to Australia, the bomb threats kept on going. They kept on doing bomb threats against me. They were sending it out to random places around Brisbane. They did bomb threats against my mum and my dad. Just random bomb threats around Brisbane.
That your parents were
got a bomb replaced, trying to get my parents arrested and everything.
They have a ransom? Like, yes, they said they wanted your mother dead, and they paid people.
This is the cool thing. It just kept on escalating to the point that it was so, so crazy. Like, at one point they started sending out emails, and they forwarded the email to me to just mess with my head, and it was basically like $50,000 in Bitcoin to whoever kills Drew's mum. Vanessa Pavlou, like their actual names and everything, whoever kills his dad, whoever kills his brother, 50,000 to whoever kills Drew, and make sure you torture him first and cut off his fingers, cut off his toes and stuff. Like, it was just sick stuff. And at this point, like, I was going to the Australian Federal Police, like, what can you guys do to protect us? And they had to visit my family home, and they had to like talk to my parents and everything. It was like terrifying. And it just unfortunately got to the point where I was legitimately like, I actually just can't, like, I can't keep being a protester like in the way that I once was. And basically my family was begging me to stop. My loved ones were begging me to stop. And I said to them, like, okay, like, you know, I'll always be like a critic of the CCP. I'll sort of like, you know, I'll be on big on Twitter and everything. And I'll criticize them a lot on Twitter, and I'll have a big online presence and stuff, but I'm not going to like do like, you know, like activism in person, like I was doing it. And
it's the threats have calmed down.
Sorry, what'd you say?
The threats have calmed down since
well,
then.
That's the crazy thing. To be honest, I actually haven't even calmed down. So, like, to this day, like, and I'm not even, like, doing in-person protests anymore. The Chinese, would you believe it? The Chinese foreign minister came to Australia just a month ago, and it was, like, the first time a senior CCP official had visited Australia in, like, 8 years, even before, since before I was a protester. And, like, the old Drew would have loved to go and protest there, but I actually didn't because I was trying so hard to be, like, I'm a changed man. I'm studying law now. I'm going to be calm and mature and everything. So I'm not even doing these protests anymore. Drew's become more mature and everything, but still the crazy threats continue. And like I've had to be in constant liaison with the Australian Federal Police and stuff like that because there's just like constant threats against my life. And yeah,
what's your goal with studying law? Like, what are your future plans?
Politics. It's a tough one, right? Like, look, one day I really would like to be in politics because I want to change things. I genuinely think that, like, when it comes to the CCP and when it comes to, like, the battle against the dictatorships, like, I think, like, Russia, Iran, China, they've formed, like, basically a new axis of steel against, like, democracies. And I really think that, like, we've got to be stronger in combating foreign interference. We've got to be stronger in building up, like, our national capacity, building up our ability to fight back against this. Because I honestly think, sadly, I think it's a situation somewhat analogous to the 1930s where we're heading into some dark times where these dictatorships are on the march. And I've become like a huge supporter of Ukraine. When the war broke out back in 2022, when the full scale invasion took place. And I guess this was like when I was much more like active and a bit more like crazy with my activism and stuff. Like, I dropped everything and I went over to Eastern Europe to deliver supplies and stuff. And we went to like, we visited Lviv and everything, which was like only a couple weeks into the war. And I wanted to go on to Kiev just after they liberated the suburbs of Kiev. And my parents basically were like, if you do that, we're disowning you. So I didn't do that in the end. Cause they're just like, it's funny. My parents are like, Greek Australian parents. They're not political really. They just wanted me to keep my head down and stay out of trouble and just get a job and stuff like that.
So how did you become so obsessed with politics?
To an extent, it's autism, I guess. Like,
are you actually autistic?
Oh, no, I don't think I'm actually, but I guess I probably am on the spectrum a little bit. Like, I
ADHD?
Look, I definitely have ADHD. I got fully diagnosed with that and everything.
Okay, that makes sense.
But, like, it is, like, you're just, like, just this thing, I guess, where, like, young blokes, when they're, like, young and they're, like, hot-blooded, and normally, like, you know, a century ago, maybe they would have gone off to, like, fight in battles and everything and, like, I just thought, like, I've got to fight for against injustices wherever I see it, and I've got to like stand up for something. And legitimately, when I was reading about like what happened to the Uyghurs and the Tibetans and everything, like I was like when I was a teenager, reading about the Holocaust like really, really deeply impacted me to the extent that I'm a little bit of a weird person, right? Like, I get really obsessive about like politics, and it's hard for people who are just normal to understand because like they don't really get it. They're like, you're not Chinese. Why would you drop everything in your life to like care so much about this issue? And it was just like the fact that like, you know, when I was 12, 13 years old, I would read so much about the Holocaust and I watched Schindler's List and stuff like that. And it like really haunted me. And I like made a pact with myself, like, you know, should these things ever happen again, I need to make sure that I fight against it. I don't want to be somebody who just was silent in the face of atrocities and everything. That was honestly how it was. And I visited the Melbourne Holocaust Museum and I met a guy, Willie Lerma, who had an Auschwitz tattoo. And he had actually like known the Auschwitz camp commandant, Eamon Goethe, who's like, he's an infamous character in Schindler's List if you watch the film and read the book. And he was so brutal. And he was telling me about his experiences and everything. And also just even in school, like I did some big sort of like research project on Rwandan genocide and everything. And so like, I got like really quite obsessive and
like the human capacity for evil.
Yeah, literally. That. And also it's kind of scary. Like, I honestly think like that's kind of how my politics have changed over time, because like, I think I used to be much more optimistic about human nature. And so that's why I was like much more kind of like out and out like a leftist and everything. And so like when I started out, I certainly thought of myself as like a democratic socialist and stuff like that. And the thing that really inspired me like when I was a teenager was like Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign and everything. I was following that obsessively and everything as a kid. And so like I started out really much as a leftist, and I was so optimistic about like human nature and the ability to like, you know, change the world through like, you know, great grand progressive reforms and everything. And then just as I've gotten older and I've like legitimately seen the human capacity for evil, like the fact that I've literally got like a Uyghur friend whose mum got taken to a re-education camp because he was talking to me in Australia. And the fact that like I have friends who have family members with the scars of torture and stuff from Chinese gulags and stuff like that. The fact that I had people who were trying to kill me and trying to like rape and death threats against my mom and things like that. The fact that I went to Ukraine, you know, 5 weeks into the war, 6 weeks into the war in 2022, and I was meeting families and kids that had fled from places like Mariupol where the whole place was just razed to the ground. And you'd see like the 1,000-yard stare of these kids that were just haunted. Like these things really made a deep impression on me. And I think it's in a way like, I definitely don't identify. I still, it's kind of a funny thing because I still see myself as kind of like moderate left kind of thing, like maybe like centrist, but leaning left. But I certainly like am just like completely broken from like those sort of like the activist left, like the socialist left, you know, like I've completely broken with that because like just especially, and even just as well, like the stuff that I've seen since October 7, where I had friends, people I thought were my friends that celebrated October 7 and were like, this is what decolonization looks like. And it was just like, and I watched all the photos and I looked at all the video footage of October 7 and I saw just the most horrific things, like families butchered and just horrors beyond all imagination. I saw all this sickening stuff. I felt a need to see it, like to be a witness, you know, like not to look away from it. And then the fact that I saw so many people who were just like it was just like, it just kind of became like a sort of trend. A lot of the time, this is a thing, right? Like a lot of the time, I think it's actually like thoughtlessness or ignorance. Like it's just, it kind of just becomes the trendy thing because people see it on their Instagram stories and everything. And like, it just becomes the trendy position. Like, yeah, like this is decolonization. It's a resistance operation. And it's like, my God, like this is the largest single day massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. And the thing that originally motivated me to be an activist against the Uyghur genocide and the Tibetan genocide and stuff was actually studying the Holocaust as a teenager and everything. And so that just left a really deep impression on me. And
yeah. So, yeah. Like same with me with October 7th. Like I didn't really pay that much attention to Ukraine. I feel a bit guilty saying that, but I was like, I don't know. I've obviously felt sorry for the Ukrainians and thought that it was disgusting what Russia was doing, but it didn't keep me up at night. And since October 7th and understanding that there is this alliance between Iran, Russia, and China, and it deeply threatens everything I stand for and everything our country stands for.
Yeah. Literally everything I believe in. That's the thing, right? Like I don't think people understand just how comprehensive, like this grouping, like I don't think people realize just how comprehensively this grouping rejects everything we believe in and stand for. Like even if you're just like a normie, someone who's just like not even really interested in politics and stuff like that, but you just generally want to be left alone and just live a normal life. Like because you don't have the government like torturing people, rounding up people, like just whisking people up from the streets, disappearing people. Like just the basic freedoms and protections we enjoy in liberal democratic societies and stuff like that. Even if you just want to be a normie, like just leave politics to the side. These powers, they completely represent the complete rejection of that, you know, like they want to impose like totalitarian rule in a society like Iran, in a society like Russia, in a society like China. You criticize the government, even if you don't criticize the government, if somebody hears something that you say and it's taken the wrong way, you can literally be disappeared and whisked off the streets. And I have friends that has happened to their family members inside China and stuff like that. And then I went to Ukraine and I saw the kids that were affected. And so now it keeps me up at night. And like, that's why I said, like, maybe I'm a bit of a weird person because a lot of people just don't like to think about these things. But like, to me, I'm like, my ability to like live for the next, like, I hope that I'll be able to live a full and happy life. Maybe the profession that I've gone into maybe won't facilitate that. But like, I hope that I'll be able to live a full and happy life and have a beautiful family and just live, you know, live with the benefits of freedom, not having to worry about like being kidnapped and disappeared because I criticized.
And that's what everyone wants. It's literally not a culturally relative thing. Like, and that's evidenced by the fact that lots of people from these totalitarian countries want to move to here, to the West, to have what we have. So,
It's
so
terrifying.
What is it about people, you know, I'm thinking Bad Empanada and all these idiots. Is it just a grift? Is it just that they know they can make money and they've got their friends? You know, I was in leftist circles and I loved the sort of identity and the power it gave me. Is it just that?
It's all, it's, this is the thing, right? Like, it's all sorts of different reasons motivate people. And like, if you even study like the history of the Holocaust and stuff like that, like, it's very much the same thing. Like, there were people who were Nazis because they were like fully fervent ideological believers in like the entire race series and stuff like that. And then there were people who became Nazis just due to social pressure. And they still, and these people, like, they just carried out atrocities out of social pressure and a desire for conformity and stuff like that. And then there's obviously grifters and stuff like that. And it, like, there's a whole range of reasons that motivate people and stuff like that. And it's scary. Like, you've got people like Jackson Hinkle, where I think honestly for him, it's like just money and attention. Like, I struggle to believe that he really believes in the things that he believes in. Like, I think for him, it's really.
Can we go through his history a bit and who he is?
Yeah.
Because I never heard about him until October 7th. Had you heard of him before?
Oh, I debated him 6 months before October 7th. I debated him at the start of 2023 because I knew him from his pro-Russia stuff. So this is the crazy.
So he's always been pro-Russia. Okay.
So this is the thing. Like, he blew up on Twitter after October 7th because he was like really pro-Hamas and everything. And I guess he was just like generic. Like he, honestly, it's just because he looks like this is going to sound dumb, right? Like, there's a certain category of like sort of like leftist influencer, and you've got like Hasan Piker, and you've got like Jackson Hinkle and stuff like that. And like, these are guys who, like, you know, I guess they're conventionally good looking and everything. And so people are like, oh, like, they just hold them up as like avatars for their movement and stuff like that. Cause like, it's cause a lot of people are just literally dumb and they just like can't even get beyond phrenology. So like, they're like, oh, this guy is a critic of China, but I can make fun of how he looks, therefore blah, blah, blah. Anyway, there are people who like literally just hold them up for those reasons. And I think that was part of it. Like, Jackson Hinkle's
like a blonde Aryan looking guy who's supporting Hamas.
Literally, his main support, like his main following, I think, is definitely outside of America. Like, I think it's mainly like people in the Middle East, and like, he's just got like all these random followers from like Pakistan.
Bots.
And all these, yeah,
Russian bots.
And like, he's got like followers all from like Morocco and Pakistan and stuff like that. And I think it's partly like, here is like a white Aryan guy who's like backing my cause to the full extent.
Yeah.
I think it's partly that. And it's like, I think it's partly that. That's why he became so famous and everything. But originally I knew him because he was like a MAGA communist. And basically it's this really grifty thing where like they identify as Stalinists and like Marxist-Leninists and stuff like that, but they support Trump because they think Trump is going to like usher in. It doesn't even make sense. It's just like a complete stupidity where like they position themselves where they're like, they're against wokeness and everything. But then like they support like legitimate Stalinism and all this cooked stuff. And it's just weird. It's a stupid, weird ideology. I knew him because he was like advocating like full on genocide against Ukraine. Like, I had a full debate with him and he would just laugh. Like, I'd bring up like just all this evidence of Russian atrocities. Like, there was one really psychopathic moment where like I brought up the bombing of Mariupol Drama Theater, where basically 1,000 civilians had hunkered in the basement trying to like flee the Russian bombardment. And they had written in Russian characters outside in Cyrillic, they had written children on the pavement, basically trying to say, this is a humanitarian designation. This is a humanitarian zone. The Russian pilots bombed it from the air and about 1,000 people died. And like when they eventually occupied Mariupol, they just bulldozed the wreckage. And there's just all these decomposing bodies underneath the wreckage of the Mariupol Drama Theater. Like, that's a scary thing. We don't know how many people died, but it was hundreds and hundreds of people. And I brought this up and Jackson legit just laughed. Like, he legitimately laughed. So he's like a full on believes in nothing. There is legitimately a new ideology that's arisen. And I think it's basically like, I think Konstantin Kissin said this, and I know he's like, I know he's like more conservative. So for me to like cite him, I'm going to get canceled or whatever, but he called it like race communism. And to be honest, it kind of is that. Like, it's kind of like partly like it's sort of grievance race-based nationalism. So it's like they hate the West and they hate every single nation state on earth, except for like the nation states that they agree with, like Palestine or like indigenous ethno states and stuff like that. Like, this is what they believe in, I guess. And then they also want like just like full communism. And it's sort of like Mao's, it's like Mao's third worldism kind of thing. And they often will joke like, oh, we want to genocide the first world. And like.
So just to finish up, like,
yes.
Who do you get the most amount of hate from right now online?
This is the funny thing. Like, half of it is from communists and half of it is from like legitimate national socialist Nazis. Like, so I get like legitimate communists, the tankies, the people like Bad Empanada and stuff, like, and they'll just be like, we will have a revolution. We'll put you up against the wall. You're a reactionary, blah, blah, blah. Like I get a heaps of death threats from those types of people, like pro CCP people, communists and stuff like that. Hamas supporters as well. Like, I had a point where like someone was like, I live in Drew's street. I'm going to get him, like, just bullshit. Like, and it was just anonymous accounts. And that was like a guy who had like the Hamas red triangle symbol in his thing. The other thing is like, I legitimately get so much hate from Nazis. Cause like I see like, since Elon Musk changed a lot of the moderation on Twitter, like they've literally brought back like legit Nazi people. Like for example, in Australia, National Socialist Network and Thomas Sewell and stuff like that. Like people who like legit do like the Hitler CKL and stuff like that. And they openly say like, we want to deport all non-white people. They say that they want to have like a white ethnostate and stuff like that. And just because like I criticize their stupid ethnostate psycho politics. And like they actually like say that they're Holocaust deniers, they're anti-Semites and stuff like that. They're complete psychos. Like they're domestic terror threats basically. And because I criticize them because they're fucking psychos, like they go like, oh, Drew's like a mongrel, he's a race mixed dog, he's not actually Greek, he's Turkish. Like, oh yeah, he's like disgusting, like racist stuff. Like it's crazy. So like it's actually funny that like half the threats these days and half the attacks are like legit Nazi extreme right. For some reason, they think that I'm like this like they think I'm like this like socialist open borders guy when I'm not even like that. But they hate me because probably just because like I'm like I guess it's funny since I grew my beard like they started calling me like an Arab terrorist and stuff like that, which is just so cool. So like maybe because I'm like a little bit slightly ethnically ambiguous. And then the other thing is, like, I get the communists who, like, legit want to kill me because, like, I'm anti-CCP and stuff. They're both fucking terrors. They're both, like, evil forces, and I'm just both going to keep on... I'm going to keep on going against both because, like, both represent, like, an evil threat to democracy and liberal democracy. And as you said, like, I just want the basic liberal values that I've grown up with, like, the right to be free from, like, you know, government tyranny and people trying to control my life and trying to tell me what to do and, like, wanting me to be, like, a slave. I will never accept that ever, and I'll always fight to try and uphold like the values that I grew up with, which is like a liberal, open, freedom, free society, knowing that you can criticize the government and not be disappeared in a black bag the next day.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
And you know, both our ancestors on the Greek side, at least, or Greek Cypriot side, you know, came to this country to make a better life, and you know, there's so much we have to protect. About Australia,
literally,
and people
literally.
who just take it for granted, like these things aren't.
I hate the whole trendy thing on the left where it's like, we're going to abolish Australia and we're going to like tear it all down and burn everything. It's like, no, I'm actually really thankful that I live in Australia and my family came to Australia and like it's a beautiful society and there's so many opportunities for me. And you know, I've never been held back because my family came from Cyprus or whatever. Like it's a beautiful country. I love Australia. I completely identify as Australian and I want to protect Australia and the values that I grew up with and the democracy that I grew up in. I don't want to see Australia abolished or destroyed like these psychos do. And the crazy thing is like, it's both the communists who want to destroy Australia and also the Nazis, because like the Nazis, they're fighting for an Australia that is completely unrecognizable. Like where if you've got a black friend or whatever, your black friend's going to be killed because like that's their vision. So I don't want to live in their world of bloodshed and horror and evil. Like I just want to live in a nice society, nice picket fences where people can have a lovely family and raise kids and have a nice Labrador dog and just legit. Like I realize that normally things are actually like quite good. They're actually quite good. Like burning everything
is
down
to the
ground.
Is that a new thing that you've realized?
Yeah.
I've become a bit like that too as I've gotten older.
Legit. Like I just realized that like suburbia isn't the most boring evil thing in the world. Like when I was a kid, I was like, oh, that's the worst life ever. I don't want to be like that. Like, no, I actually just want to have like nice family, nice house to myself, have a nice dog, have like nice kids, have a lovely home. That's all I want. Just normal things. And these people want to fucking destroy it all.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. Well, we should probably, wrap it up now.
Yes. Thank you.
Until next time, we'll have to do another episode.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Zoe. Yeah. Thank you, Colette. And, I can't wait to be, I guess, like purged from the left for appearing on this podcast. It'll be good.
Good. Welcome to the club.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.